The Tom Woods Show, episode 2037.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, Tom Woods here. Don't forget you can get one of my books in audiobook format for free. So that includes my book, Real Descent, which is narrated by me. My New York Times bestseller, Meltdown on the Financial Crisis of 2008, featuring a foreword by Ron Paul, Nullification, and others. Just head over to tomwoodsaudio.com, sign up for Audible, and if you decide you don't want Audible, you get to keep the free audiobook they give you anyway. tomwoodsaudio.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Michael Malice Week continues. We're going to get into his book, The Anarchist Handbook, which did extremely well upon its release. It's a collection of articles and excerpts from people across the ideological spectrum who have identified as anarchists over the years. And some of them contradict each other. Some of them have wildly impractical ideas, but some of them have penetrating insights as well. It's very, very much worth reading, if only as an exercise in intellectual history, but perhaps also to help us think more creatively about the kinds of problems we face today. So I'll link to the book at tomwoods.com/2037. And as I say, on these show notes pages this week, I'll also have links to Tom Woods Show episodes that are going to go into more depth on the nuts and bolts of how this works or how that works. So Michael, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, let's talk more about the Anarchist Handbook. But first of all, yeah, I guess I noticed, are you a little congested? Are you under the weather?
Yeah, like I hope this is Omicron because this is the healthiest I've ever been when I've ever been sick. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, and by the way, of course I remember because you were asking me the other day about because you were not feeling well. And I didn't know that you were still unwell.
Yeah, I have my sense of taste. I'm not particularly tired. I had to sleep an extra 2 hours yesterday. I coughed up phlegm less than 10 times total. So in terms of like, I had a sore throat when I went to bed and it was fine when I woke up. So in terms of symptoms, I feel like this is how Superman gets sick. They're all resolving, but it's just, I'm still a little croaky. It's very weird because we all forget what it's like to have regular sickness.
Yeah, yeah, no kidding. Well, I'm glad it's not crushing you. So that's good.
Like I had a mild fever. I didn't take my temperature, but like while I was asleep and it's gone.
Well, one good thing is talking to old Woods. It has a very healing, natural calming effect.
Yeah, yeah, so. Yeah. You put people to sleep.
That's kind of where I was going with it.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, I get somebody saying, you know, we put your podcast on and it puts our three-month-old right out. Yeah. It's right out.
It's like a hypnotist.
Yeah.
And now the kid thinks he's a chicken.
All right. Let's talk more about the Anarchist Handbook, which in audiobook form, as we said in the previous episode, is read by as many people as there are chapters.
Yes,
and
sir.
I am the reader of chapter 20. The Murray Rothbard chapter, which is great. But I've actually done a whole episode on Anatomy of the State, so we don't need to revisit that. Plus, I want to talk about things that my listeners are less likely to have heard of. They know, you know, I've had David Friedman on a couple of times. I have talked about Rothbard quite a bit. I don't think I've ever mentioned the Tannehill, so maybe we'll get back to them
really?
At some point. I read their book, is it Uncle Sam the Monopoly Man? Is that
no,
their book?
No, The Market for Liberty.
The Market for Liberty. Sorry, that was, it starts with a W, I can't remember. But The Market for Liberty, yes. And I think that's like the early 70s or 1970 or something like that.
Correct, yeah.
Yeah. That is a great book and it's often overlooked, apparently, including by me. So I wouldn't mind revisiting that. But as I look here, there are some items in here that are quite shocking. Like Chapter 9, our friend Most talking about dynamite and how you would get some and how you'd fashion it. And apparently this provoked a big free speech controversy because if somebody is going to tell the whole world a simple way of obtaining and making explosives, obviously this is going to have a negative consequence for society.
Well, no, you're saying obviously, but that's not his perspective.
Well, it's not his perspective. I'm saying that his critics would put it that way, and that's why he needs to be suppressed. I mean, the same thing has been said about a lot of other things, that there was a book in Spain on how to beat your wife without leaving a mark.
Wow. It's and a some whole
people,
book?
Yeah. I don't understand how there could be a whole book on this. But and so there was some thought that, look, we understand the case for free speech, but here you have a book that couldn't possibly have any real merit in the real world. It could only do harm. So in that case, why in that case shouldn't we suppress a book like that? Well, likewise, why shouldn't we suppress a book telling people how to make dynamite?
Well, I mean, the thing is, that's like saying dynamite shouldn't be made. Dynamite has many indisputably useful purposes.
It's true.
So, I mean, to have a book that's like how to make dynamite, I think it's almost impossible to say this can only have negative societal consequences.
Maybe so. Maybe so. But I suppose it would be like saying, I've got a book on how people can make suitcase nukes that they might be able to sneak into various jurisdictions.
Sure. But again, suitcase nukes, there's no like industrial use for. Dynamite, there is enormous. What's interesting when I'm writing my next book, The White Pill, how many roads go through St. Petersburg? So Ayn Rand was obviously from there. Emma Goldman lived there before she moved to New York, up to upstate New York. And Alfred Nobel, who was the creator of dynamite, he spent time there as well. So it was really interesting to see this Venn diagram of the three of them. But no, what happened with the Johann Most is, you know, he had this book, which is How to Make Dynamite and Other Explosives. This came out in the like 1870s, I believe, which was translated into English. He was German-born anarchist. He had some kind of frostbite on his face as a kid, and then it became cancer. So they put out a piece of his jaw, so it was all deformed, so he had this big beard. And this was really regarded as an example, or not example, a mechanism for the working class to have a measure of parity with the ruling oppressive capitalist class. And I got to tell you, a lot of this rhetoric is similar to contemporary times where we say the reason America is in Australia is because everyone's got an AR.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's another essay in there by Charles Robert Plunkett called Dynamite. And it's from, I think, like 1905. And his whole point is like, wait. We are striking to not be dismembered, to feed our families, to work like only 14 hours a day, right? And you guys have cops, you have cannons, you have bullets. You're beating the crap out of us and our women and children. We don't even have bread. Screw this. We don't owe you people anything. Like next time you come at us with bullets, we're coming at you with dynamite. And the line in there is, and let us strike first, which is a very obviously inflammatory, no pun intended, term to say. So when Johann Most's pamphlet came out, in Europe especially, you know, to have bomb throwers and anarchism were side by side, this they were regarded as largely synonymous and not inaccurately. This was a sea change in the relationships of the power dynamic between the state or the forces of property and, you know, the laborers.
I can't help thinking about Alexander Berkman, who's in here, who shot Henry Clay Frick. I guess, no?
No, he couldn't shoot him, so he had to stab him.
Oh!
He bungled that assassination attempt. Or he shot him once, but barely, you know?
Okay, because Frick has a letter that he wrote, because if it wasn't Berkman who shot him...
No, it was Berkman, but I meant... He wasn't injured really from the bullet. It was much more the knife.
Okay, because Frick actually wrote a letter to somebody that very day in which almost as a throwaway line, he says, these were his exact words, was shot twice today, though not seriously.
Yeah.
Just as a throwaway. That would be the lead of my letter.
No, and the other thing is, there's a whole backstory here. This was the Homestead Strike in near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Frick, who was Carnegie's right-hand man, basically wanted the workers to take a pay cut, which was part of the terms of their contract or whatever. The union went on strike. Frick said, you're all fired, so you can't even be on strike. You don't work here anymore. They start bringing in scabs. They call them the Pinkertons. It gets very bloody and violent. But, you know, when Berkman comes in and tries to kill him, like, he doesn't even take an ambulance, I don't think. And Frick sends out a press release right after he was stabbed being like, we're not budging one iota. Like, we're going to win this war. And he was right. They completely crushed the union. And everyone denounced Berkman, including Johann Most.
Most, yeah.
Who was just like, Berkman's my enemy. You know, Johann Most had this term called the propaganda of the deed, which is if you're an anarchist and you kill someone or you set off a bomb, boast about it. A, it makes your enemy scared, but it'll also make the population be drawn to you. But Most's point is, you can't have propaganda of the deed if the deed is bad. It's got to be like you're unambiguously fighting an injustice. And what did this accomplish? Nothing.
What struck me about the Berkman selection is that these days, a lot of people who call themselves anarchists will rush to correct you if you are under the impression that anarchism means chaos and gunfights in the streets and, you know, assassinations of high-profile people. And they say, oh, no, that's not what we mean. But Berkman more or less said, well, that kind of is what we mean, because that works. It disrupts the system. If there are people who are oppressing you, just go, why would you not take the direct approach?
And it's also even funnier because Leon Czolgosz, who in 1901 killed President McKinley, Berkman and Goldman broke over that. Berkman was in jail for the attempted assassination of Frick. And he's like, McKinley? Like, that's your great villain? The guy's a non-entity. Like, he's a symptom of this bigger problem. Like, give it a... Are you kidding me? And whereas Emma Goldman was much more sympathetic to the assassination. But it was also really funny because Czolgosz gets arrested and they're like, why'd you kill McKinley? And he's like, Emma Goldman told me. And she's like, God damn it. So then she has to like go on the lam because this crazy person who she barely knew, met like once at an event, you know, is blaming her. And it became this whole kind of rigmarole. And they arrested her and then they had to free her from lack of evidence, which was kind of shocking because she refused to even condemn him. She even said, what's the big deal if a president gets killed? We're all equal. So it's like the balls on this woman is just insane. But it's also interesting because both of them were deported to the Soviet Union by Woodrow Wilson and J. Edgar Hoover, who was just getting his feet wet in terms of being a nice little authoritarian. And when they got to there, they, you know, completely denounced it. And they each wrote books about it. And the last chapter of Goldman's book, she's like, I'm not saying I'm against violence, but violence isn't like oppressing the entire working class through the state. That's worse than the czar.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things I like about Emma Goldman. And I know this about her because of you, actually. The Berkman thing actually has to do, the selection has to do with prisons.
Yeah.
And his argument is that they just don't do any good. That first, they certainly do not reform people. If somebody gets out of a penitentiary, right? It's supposed to be a penitent. Somebody is sorry for what he's done and he's going to be made better by the institution.
Tom, can I interrupt you?
Yeah.
I'm in my late 60s and this is the first time I put two and two together that that's the etymology of that term.
Oh, okay.
Isn't that embarrassingly stupid?
No, but it's because you use it all the time. You don't think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't think about it because it's a joke. Like, I know this was like kind of this religious idea why they had jails, but like no one with a straight face thinks you go to jail and you have, oh, I'm so penitent. That's not a thing.
Yeah, no, that is definitely not a thing. It's either A, they screwed me and that's why I'm in here, or B, I'm guilty, but I don't particularly feel like being imprisoned. And that's what Berkman says, that what you're bringing about is a resentful, angry sort of person who's not going to be reintegrated well into society. So there's all that. But then he also says, if what you're doing it for is to exact revenge, well, revenge is like one of the basest motives possible. So he says, the system is just not going to do what you want it to do. It's just not going to do any good. But of course, I don't know. I haven't read the whole thing. So suppose you do have somebody, let's say it's not somebody who stole three oranges from the cart, but a genuinely dangerous, violent person. I don't know what Berkman's solution is. And I don't mean to have the boomer response, well, then what do you think propose that we should do? But in this case, I kind of do want to know.
So I read his book called The ABCs of Anarchism, and I was looking for this exact point. So one of their big arguments, the anarcho-communists or the original anarchists, is that theft and crime is a function of poverty and despair. Okay, I can wrap my head around that, sure. And it's like, if people had more money, there'd be less, you know, theft and crime. Okay, sure. But that's it. I'm like, well, what about like someone who rapes kids, right? That's not happening because you're poor. That's not really happening because you're oppressed. Like there's something, people who are profoundly mentally ill, sure, you can make that weird argument that capitalism causes mental illness, fine. But when it's never organic, it's never a function of brain damage or something like that. So I think there is a huge gaping hole in, you know, anarchist thought on the left where they want to reduce all crime to, you know, a few bare factors. And that's why the criticism of them as utopian in this regard is, I think, somewhat valid. It's like, I'll even accept for the sake of argument that 90% of crimes, you know, would not happen in that situation. Great. What about this 10%? Like, those are the ones I'm really worried about.
Yeah.
Like, if you're asking me, if America had 20% more shoplifting, okay, I that would not be the end of the world. But if we're talking about like 20% more murder or sexual assaults, this is irrevocable.
I think it's also worth noting that there wasn't any particularly noticeable spike in crime, at least in the U.S., during the Great Depression. And you would think if it's a matter of material deprivation, we should have seen something.
Well, and wouldn't it? We didn't. Wait, let me ask you this. Would it be because, you know how Biden is touting his economic record? Because, well, if you shut down all business in 2020, then yeah, 2021 is going to be a massive improvement.
Yeah.
So is it possible that there was no spike in crime during the Great Depression because the 1920s had prohibition?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Because you had the crime through the roof during prohibition. So that might have skewed the data.
Yeah, I guess that's possible. I would have to, I don't know. I'd have to find out about that. But I think we agree that the claim that crime is exclusively a result of material deprivation, I just don't think that, like, it reminds me of the 19th century utopian socialists who
right.
created various communities in the U.S., and they were either going to get rid of private property or alcohol or monogamous marriage or whatever it was, and there was always some outside thing that was harming human beings, and that human beings liberated from these things would experience a renaissance. There'd be a vast, education. Horace Mann said that there would be a reduction in crime of 90% if we could just get rid of ignorance through education. So it's never in the human heart, right? It's always in ignorance or alcoholism or whatever. But maybe it is in part in the human heart. Maybe we have to acknowledge that at some level.
And the economic crimes aren't the ones I'm really worried about.
Right.
Like, yeah. Again, if stealing bread, even stealing cars, like if you gave me a thing on the table, you know, stealing bread, stealing cars, sexual assault, murder, harming children, take as many cars as you want. Like, this is not really anywhere near as big for me as a concern in terms of what makes a civilized society as the last three things I mentioned.
Now, this has nothing to do with what we were just talking about, but I just want to jump arbitrarily to Herbert Spencer because I forgot he was in here and I've always really liked him. He has a terrible reputation, as do a lot of great people.
Really? You think he does?
Yeah, because he's viewed as, they call him a social Darwinist.
Well, he invented, he was the first one.
Roderick Long has a good essay about this, and Roderick being a bleeding heart, I'm inclined to believe him. I'll dig it up. The essay we're talking about here, though, is the one that he removed from his Social Statics book, which is a shame because it's the best part of the book, which is the essay on the right to ignore the state. And it's so beautifully put. I mean, it sounds like it's something an agorist would write today.
Yes.
About the state is fundamentally different from other institutions and it operates through violence and it is thought of as having legitimacy in people's minds. But what if it really doesn't? Then I should have the right to ignore it. I like that because there's a simplicity to the moral argument that really grabs you. I tend to avoid saying to people, here, I'm going to argue for anarchism. Instead, I say, well, I'm going to argue for why in this case, freedom is the best solution. And in this case, it's the best solution. I figure if I win enough of those, they'll fill in the rest of the gaps themselves. I don't have the ambition to throw the whole ball of wax at them all at once. I try to make them think about this, think about this, think about this. And once I kind of get them on board, then it's only a matter of time before they come to me and say, oh, by the way, I figured out how we'd handle the roads.
But can I say something else? Let me ask you this, Tom. You know how you and I've discussed how some certain types of libertarians, if you criticize Twitter or Facebook,
they're it's a private company.
They can do whatever they want.
Yeah.
So like writing a bad Yelp review, a factually bad Yelp review after you had a bad experience is somehow a human rights violation.
Yeah.
Or violates the NAP. It's completely nonsensical. And in fact, social pressure is how the market regulates behavior outside of the law. Does it also drive you crazy? This one really, when I hear this, I'm like, this person's completely mindless. When you hear conservatives, we as a society have decided that. And it's like, oh my God, just stop.
Yeah,
just stop.
I know.
So that with regards to the law, it's like they're more conservatives are in many ways more authoritarian than leftists because leftists will blatantly tell you that many laws should not only be ignored, but should be defied. And they're right. I mean, there's no one who can't think of many laws historically that have been insane and abhorrent, just not, or nonsensical. and you could, you know, just whatever. But well, we as a society decided, who's we?
Yeah, because obviously right now you're arguing with somebody who doesn't agree with you, so I'm not part of society?
Or that decision's been irrevocably made? Societies can't change their minds?
Yeah, exactly. How many other decisions are like this? Once you make it, can never change.
Right.
I've changed my mind on a lot of things. But so, of course, I guess the idea would be, well, if you don't accept these ground rules, then you're not part of society. But okay, so then I don't get any input at all because you've just, how did you get to be in charge?
Right, right. How are you the one who's the doorman?
And then even if it's, well, a bunch of people elected me, how did they get the power to elect you?
Right.
Who said that they could do that?
Yeah, somehow, like if I want to go to the supermarket, I have to ask my neighbors for permission to what food I get.
Hey, everybody, quick sponsor message from Skillshare. There is no better time than New Year's resolution time to get yourself out of your comfort zone, find something that brings you joy, or take an existing interest or hobby and go to the next level. One membership at Skillshare, and I'm going to show you in a minute how to get a free month, gets you access to thousands and thousands of classes in topics like animation, creative writing, film and video, and that includes classes on how to get started in indie film, stuff like that. Graphic design, music, photography, web development, business analytics, freelance and entrepreneurship, leadership and management, marketing, and more. My own daughters have used it to improve their own skills in creative writing and art, and I've used it for business and productivity. So, for example, classes like Personal Branding, Crafting Your Social Media Presence by Kate Ahrens, or Social Media for the Creative Entrepreneur, Exposure, Tips, and Pros and Cons. These are the sorts of things you need to know. You need to be able to learn how to use free resources if you're going to promote yourself. And you can flounder around forever trying to figure out how to do that, or you can take a one-hour Skillshare class that has no fluff and just the information you need. These are short, to-the-point classes geared to your schedule. You can get feedback from a great community. It's an amazing experience. So explore your creativity at Skillshare.com/woods, where our listeners get a one-month free trial. That's 1 month free at Skillshare.com/woods.
Well, let me just say one more thing about the Herbert Spencer thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So Rothbard, as I mentioned in the introduction to that chapter, regarded as the best libertarian book ever written. And I was really proud for the audiobook to have my buddy Chris Williamson do that chapter. A, because he's got the perfect British accent.
Oh, good.
So I want that come through. But B, he's also a male model. And Herbert Spencer is the one who, not Darwin, Herbert Spencer is the one who coined the term survival of the fittest. So I thought it would be appropriate to have a model read that chapter.
I just love that. I would never have known the significance of that. That is great.
Yeah.
That is great. What would you say? I mean, they're all challenging in their own way, right? Every single entry in this thing challenges you in its own way. Like, as we mentioned, the Hasnis one from the point of view of the rule of law. Rothbard just goes right after what actually is the state. They're all different angles they attack from. But are there, do you have any personal favorites, and are they ones that we would not expect?
My favorite for the audiobook, because I thought it was the most inspired pairing, was I had Lauren Chen do the essay advocating the use of violence. And why I was proudest of that pairing is it's a guy named Charles Robert Plunkett. He was a bomb maker. You know, he's calling for violent revolution. And I thought, whenever you're dealing with any kind of radical ideology, there is always this temptation, like H.L. Mencken's quote, you know, every man must be tempted at time to spit on his hands, raise the black flag, and start slitting throats, right? Or every rational man, I forget the exact Mencken quote. So I'm like, this is a good idea to have a woman read this chapter because it's like the siren song of violence. Like, it's very seductive, but it's very dangerous. So I told her to read it like that, like you're seducing the reader. And if a guy would have read it, it'd be very strident. It would probably sound like Mussolini, you know, banging his fist. But that's not how seduction works. And that's not how seduction of violence works. Kind of like drowning. You're slowly going underwater. And before you know it, you're lost, right? So to have her kind of call to the reader with, there's a lot of indignation in that. It's a short essay, but indignation and kind of self-righteousness. And also, well, there's only one thing we can do, start killing people. When you have a woman, especially with a voice like hers, read it, I think it does a good job of getting us to understand how so many people are seduced by terrorism.
That is beautiful. I love that. I would not have known that that was what you were going for. But now that I do, I'm really impressed. That's even better than Woods reading Rothbard.
Yeah, actually, I told her, read this last line like a phone sex operator. Because I wanted it to be that seduction.
Yeah, perfect.
That breathy voice.
Perfect. Well,
just one more thing. She did such a good job of it that I'm thinking of having her do the audiobook for The White Pill. And I know people are going to be up in arms. You should read your own book. But the book is about despair and hope. And I think it's a lot better as I'm croaking through this interview. And Lauren's expecting, so we wish nothing but good things for her and her kid. She's a great, great woman. Her husband, Liam's a great dude. I think a female voice is much more conducive to getting that sense of despair and hope through the reader. And I'm specifically thinking of, and this is a reference you're going to love, Tom, of the figure of Columbia. Remember her?
Oh, yeah.
Well, can you tell people who Columbia is?
Well, I don't know the backstory, but it's in a way, it's like she would be equivalent of like the later Uncle Sam.
Yeah.
It's like a personification of America, but a woman, young.
Yeah, and she's often portrayed like with her arms out, pleading toward the reader, you know?
Yes, right, yes. Yeah.
Uncle Sam is pointing his finger, wagging it, but she is this very, not maternal because she's very young, she's not that mom energy, but very much like hugging, entreating energy. So I think that's kind of what I have in mind. But I don't know if I'm going to do it. I haven't even asked her this. And the book's, of course, not even done.
All right, I think this question's too hard. Let's see how Malice handles it.
Okay.
When I think about somebody like John Locke, all right, he was a great thinker and he had some great ideas, but he's not, you know, he was in the late 1600s, early 1700s, so he's not going to have the answers to everything. And, you know, he hasn't considered monopoly theory and a lot of stuff came later. But he was a pioneer in his own way, in his own time. And we can still get something out of going back and reading John Locke, but he's not the finish. He's not the period at the end of the sentence. Well, likewise with anarchism. I mean, I feel like when I read somebody like Hasnas, he brings something to the table that might have implicitly been there in earlier thinkers, but wasn't brought out the way he brought it out.
Correct.
So there's a sense in which we can learn from reading our, you know, forerunners in this tradition. We can learn something from them. But is there a way we can think of what can they learn from us? Is there anything incomplete about the way they thought of anarchism where we've advanced and we've had more insights since then? Like the masses are even worse than you thought, for example.
Well, I think a lot of the anarcho-communists, I think a very obvious answer would be like Mises and the calculation problem.
Yes, that's an advance.
That's a big one. The fact that, you know, oh, communism works in theory, not in practice. It doesn't work in theory because you can't have prices without a market mechanism, which is dynamic and changes constantly to allocate resources and give information to everyone, literally, in terms of, you know, what is needed, what is a surplus, and so on and so forth. That, I think, is a big deal. I think that's a major one. Other than that, I also think that you mentioned the Tannehills earlier with the market for liberty. It's a lot easier to make the case for market-based anarchism with the internet than it would have been in 1970. Because in terms of private roads, for example, right? You don't have to have any ideology to know that I've got an app on my phone and I could put in my app, do I want to maximize for time, which might be more expensive, or do I want to maximize my route for cheapest, which might be a little longer? I don't have to know capitalism, Marxism, anarchism, just the market's giving me this choice,
right.
The state's giving me this choice, I'll do whatever. So things like that, and I mentioned this in the New Right, in terms of things like free speech, you can't censor a book now. I can make infinite copies at my house, just copy a document. I could send it anywhere on earth at the speed of light, and I could have a password so no one can open it. If I told you this 20 years ago, you'd think I was a crazy person, and you'd be right, but not for this reason.
All right, let's continue this conversation tomorrow. In the meantime, let's give people the link. They want to get the book, or particularly the audiobook. How do they do it?
Anarchisthandbook.com or anarchistaudiobook.com.
All right, I just love that both of those were available. You could grab them. And I'm glad they're safely in your hands. So I'll also link to those at, those are not hard to remember, but in case you do, forget them. TomWoods.com/2037. We'll have the links there. All right. We'll talk some more anarchism tomorrow. Michael, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Tom.
All right. That's going to do it for us. Michael Malice Week continues tomorrow. Don't forget TomWoodsAnnouncement.com. Check that out. Sign up to be the first to find out about the announcement coming very soon. As I say, I will not be making this announcement on the podcast because it is an extremely time-sensitive announcement. And by the time the announcement got to your ears, it would be too late. I promise you will be glad you found out about it. So TomWoodsAnnouncement.com is one of your homework assignments for tonight. And we'll see you back here for more of Michael Malice Week tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.